Familiar carols, wonderful music, Christmas trees, nativity scenes, peace on earth, childhood memories. It's possible to see Christmas as a time of warm nostalgia and sentimentality. But Luke, the author of the gospel, whom all the readings have come from today, he wasn't writing a romantic and beautiful fairy tale. He was an educated man, a physician, almost certainly a member of the Hippocratic Guild of Physicians. And his gospel shows a concern for historical accuracy and attention to detail. He had obtained first-hand eyewitness statements and interviews, and he'd woven them into an orderly account. That's what he states at the formal introduction to the gospel. Interestingly, Luke's narrative of the life of Jesus doesn't start at Jesus' birth, but some months before. Luke records an eyewitness account that he must have obtained of the meeting of the pregnant Mary and the pregnant Elizabeth. And he chose to put into his gospel a homely incident of two pregnant women having a natter. I must say, it's not the stuff of which most heroic narratives are woven. So Mary had just received the strange and wonderful news that she's going to have a child called the Son of the Most High. And she runs to see her cousin Elizabeth, who also happens to be pregnant with a child who will be John the Baptist. And as Mary runs into Elizabeth's house, calling her name, the baby in Elizabeth's womb leaps. And the word that Luke uses is not that for an ordinary baby kick, but it's a great exultant leap. And Luke sees something remarkable, because from the outside, there are only two people in that room, Mary and Elizabeth. But actually, Luke sees there are four people in that room. There's Mary and Elizabeth, and there's the unborn Luke, the unborn John the Baptist, and there's the unborn Jesus. And John the Baptist is leaping for joy at the presence of Jesus in the way that the lame man is going to leap for joy later on in Luke's gospel as Jesus walks by. So Luke then places the birth narrative in its historical context when Quirinius was governor of Syria. He's reminding us that this is not a beautiful fantasy. It's the hard stuff of reality. And scholars have repeatedly shown that Luke was surprisingly accurate and precise when he was incorporating historical detail into his narrative. Now, Luke was not a sentimentalist about the human drama. In my experience, not many physicians and health professionals are. It's hard to retain sentimental illusions about humanity when you've experienced the A&E department on a Saturday night, the psychogeriatric ward, the failed CPR attempt, and the post-mortem room. In fact, the greatest danger for health professionals like you and me is that we become disillusioned, hardened, cynical, battered down by human pain, human tears, human weakness, and the apparent futility of the struggle against death and degeneration. I, for one, have some sneaking sympathy with a cynic who described life as a sexually transmitted degenerative condition with 100% mortality. So Luke's not a sentimentalist, but the historical account which he's telling is strange, shocking, and frankly weird. We are so familiar with the story of the baby in the manger that we've lost its scandal. Luke is claiming that the God who upholds the entire cosmos, the ultimate God of supreme power, intelligence, and glory, that God has actually chosen to turn himself into a pathetic, fragile, and vulnerable baby. Not some kind of Christmas card fantasy with rosy cheeks, beaming smile, and halo, but a real baby, the sort of baby who cries and sucks on a human breast and pukes and squits down his mother's front. Do you know the neonatologist's definition of a baby? A baby can be defined as a gastrointestinal tract with no sense of responsibility at either end. And this is the kind of baby that God became. A baby who needs to have his bottom wiped, who needs to be carefully wrapped up and swaddled to prevent hypothermia. In the culture of the time, babies were often despised and neglected. Interestingly, infanticide was common, even routine, in the Roman world, approved by many philosophers and statesmen. At almost exactly the same time as the birth of Jesus, a Roman physician is writing a textbook for midwives, and it includes a chapter called How to Recognize the Newborn That Is Worth Rearing. And it has a surprisingly modern-sounding neonatal examination. The baby has to be examined and all its ducts and orifices, including the anus and urethra and mouth, have to be examined to ensure that they're patent and that all the members have due sensibility and move appropriately. And it says if the baby doesn't meet this standard, then it's not worth rearing. And it was standard clinical practice for babies who were too small or weak or malformed to be exposed, strangled, or drowned at birth. In Roman culture, it was the so-called masculine virtues which were universally respected. Strength, athleticism, military prowess, courage. So of what possible significance is some puking, wailing baby, for goodness sake? The suggestion that the God of the universe might become a baby like that was ludicrous, crude, offensive, distasteful. To the Orthodox Jew, God's glory was eternally hidden from human eyes in deepest darkness, worshipped by seraphim and cherubim. To the Platonic philosophers of the time, God was mystical and immaterial, the eternal form of the good, far from the sordid realities of a stable. But in the gospel narratives, God reveals himself in physical, tangible form. And Luke revels in the paradoxes. The angels, with their astonishing message, unaccountably bypass the religious elite in Jerusalem and proclaim good tidings to a collection of half-wits on the hills. And the infant king isn't worshipped not by seraphim and cherubim, but by a bunch of shepherds who may have been imbibing a little too much wine on a cold night. And if the tradition is right that Jesus was born in a stable, interestingly, the text that was read doesn't actually mention the stable. But if it is true that he was born in a stable, then I have to say, as a professor of neonatology, it's an incredibly dodgy and dangerous place for a newborn baby. If I had been asked to give a little bit of neonatal advice to the Almighty, I would have advised against it. Swaddling clothes, fine, as long as they're freshly washed. Sharp kitchen knife to cut the cord, good idea. But a manger in a stable? No, I'm sorry, that's a very bad idea. Just think of all those anaerobic bacteria and tetanus spores. You'll just have to insist on a nice clean bed in the inn. But most strangely, God reveals himself in weakness, in fragility, in dependence. And that God in the manger can do absolutely nothing for himself. He is totally dependent on human hands to feed him, to clean him, to protect him. And yet the historic Christian faith claims, bizarrely, that at that very moment, as he's lying in the stable, he is upholding the universe by the word of his power. His divine power, his status, is not in any way demeaned by his vulnerability and his dependence. 2,000 years later, fierce ethical debates about the value of a newborn baby's life continue, as I know only too well. Is it really worth investing serious NHS resources to give a pathetic premature baby at the limits of viability a chance of survival? Perhaps we too should concentrate more on identifying the newborn that is worth rearing. And then, whatever happened to Luke's strange narrative, that crude and offensive story of a pathetic, fragile God squirming in a borrowed animal's manger? Surely that story was doomed to oblivion, compared with those eternal and beautiful truths of Orthodox Judaism and Platonic mysticism. That God in a stable stuff was a weird idea which was destined for the dustbin of history, wasn't it? And yet here we are 2,000 years later. Great convulsions have taken place in world history and thinking. The Roman Empire disintegrated, Islam rose and flowered, the Renaissance came along, the Reformation, the Enlightenment, the 20th century, they've all come and gone. Science and technology have transformed our world and our understanding. The acids of secularism have destroyed comfortable religious dogmas. And here we are in 2015. Platonic mysticism doesn't seem to have too many followers. Orthodox Judaism continues, but only as a tiny faithful remnant. And this month, somewhere between 1 and 2 billion of the planet's inhabitants will be celebrating the birth of that pathetic, fragile baby in a stable. Funny that. It's almost as though there was something in it. Why was Luke, above all the gospel writers, fascinated by the details of Mary's pregnancy and the birth narratives? Perhaps because Luke saw that if we wish to meet the God of the universe, then he's not found by escaping from our humanity in mystical experiences. We don't find God by becoming more spiritual and less human. No, God is here with us. God has become one of us. God is found in human flesh, in the stuff which we as health workers and carers touch and treat, operate on and clean every day. In the incarnation, God authenticates our humanity with all its frailty and its limitation and its brokenness. So in our modern secular age, which once again prizes the masculine virtues, which claims that autonomy and self-determination and athleticism, these are the highest possible goods, and that dependence on others is demeaning and dehumanizing, then I think the story of Christmas has special resonance. It shows that dependence does not diminish our status and our value. In fact, we all come into the world utterly and totally dependent on the love and care of others, just like Jesus of Nazareth. And we're called to treat other human beings with respect and gentleness because they too share in the vulnerability which Jesus shared. So if you're feeling jaded and burnt out this Christmas time, driven to cynicism by too much human woe, too much pain and despair, too much hypocrisy and spin, too many efficiency targets and quality indicators, may I prescribe a dose of the Christmas story? The real historical Christmas story, not that sanitized, sugary version. In fact, may I prescribe a thoughtful reading of Luke's gospel? For Luke's historical account of the life of Jesus doesn't stop at Bethlehem. It carries on to Galilee, and then to its climax in Jerusalem, and a place called the Skull. And it ends on a road to a village called Emmaus, where Jesus again appears as an unrecognized stranger. And if you're interested, there will be two seminars held here at All Souls, specifically for clinicians, seminars with Luke the physician for health professionals. They're going to be here at All Souls in January. As I've reflected on the Christmas narrative, I've realized that it's reflected in a photograph of two hands, which are up on the screens. It's a photograph taken on the neonatal unit at UCH some years ago. In fact, it's a photo of my hand and one of the babies on the unit. And I've spent some hours staring at this photograph and thought to myself, where is God in that picture? Where do you imagine God in that picture? Do you imagine God as the almighty creator, sustainer of the universe? Then he is the huge hand on the right, and ours is the tiny hand on the left. And yes, that's right. That is one way of looking at that picture. But you know, you can swing the picture around, and the God of the universe chooses to make himself the little hand, the tiny and little hand. He chooses to make himself dependent, and the world will never be the same again.